Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us on History FM Radio on liveparanormal.com and history.fm. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in live interactive chat 24/7 with our radio show hosts and other like-minded people on www.liveparanormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by full interactive media. Stop by now and join in on the fun.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Cryptoville. I'm your host, Susan McNally, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening, where the topic will be the Black Beasts of Dartmoor. Now, as I usually say every show, the name of the show is Cryptoville because it's based on my blog, which is also named Cryptoville. And if you're interested in looking further into these topics, you can visit cryptoville.wordpress.com, and you can look up the articles and see the videos that I address in these talks and, you know, make up your own mind about these things. Also, I don't seem to be able to bring up the chat room for some reason this evening, unfortunately. I'm trying to. But in the meantime, if you want to reach me, you can reach me on the blog, and you can just put a comment in there, and I'll see it and get back to you. Or you can go over to Facebook, where we have a page called Cryptoville, no surprise, and you can leave me comments there, and I'll, you know, answer your questions or acknowledge your comments, whatever. But anyway, let's get down to the business at hand. Tonight, I'm very excited to announce that we have a guest. Professor Charles Baer, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Florida in Gainesville, is joining us this evening to address some questions that I came up with about these mysterious beasts that people are seeing along and around the moors of Britain. His specialty is evolutionary genetics, so it's a perfect match as far as I'm concerned. So let me set the stage first so that we all know what we're actually talking about in case you haven't heard of these beasts that roam the moors of Britain, particularly in Dartmoor, but also in the areas of Suffolk and Norfolk. Basically, people have been seeing two types of beasts. One is dog-like and another is cat-like. The legend begins somewhere around the 1100s with the arrival of the Vikings on the Norfolk coast. They brought with them some huge, described as ferocious black dogs, as well as the Scandinavian legend that said the Norse god Odin's black hound was let loose on the countryside to wreak havoc on the world. So a combination of seeing these big black dogs they'd never seen before and hearing these terrible legends, you know, it's no wonder they got a bit scared. But despite the myth, people were reporting that they were actually seeing these big black dogs on the moors. And it wasn't just when the Vikings arrived, it continued through the 1500s. Well, then, August 4th of 1577, a famous attack occurred in the city of Bungay, which is in Suffolk County. During a terribly fierce thunderstorm, the alleged Black Dog of Bungay, as it came to be known, broke into the church and frightened the locals that were gathered there. And apparently two of them were killed and several more were mauled. And then just as suddenly as it appeared, it disappeared. Later that evening, at St. Mary's Church in nearby Blythburgh, there was a report of an encounter with this same beast. Supposedly, as it exited that church, its claws dug into the heavy church door and left scars that are still visible today. And the thing that put me onto this story was actually a Facebook friend of mine who lives in England, and she told me she'd actually been to that church, St. Mary's Church in Blythburgh, and has seen the claw marks that had been left in that door. So the Black Dog of Bungay is, you know, still very much alive in the people's minds in that area. In fact, some have taken it to heart. I mean, they've incorporated the beast into the town's coat of arms, if you can believe it. Many of the buildings in the town have images of the dog, and there's even a Black Dog weather vane that sits on top of a like a central lamppost and in a roundabout. So I don't know. It seems like these people are still very much in tune with this legend, or in fact, you know, fact. That's what we're trying to find out tonight. But the Black Dog of Bungay isn't the only one. There's another one called the Black Shook, and that's described as a spectral hound that haunts the Norfolk and Suffolk coasts. I mean, even today people are reporting sightings of this beast, and they believe that when someone sees it, it portends like a death or a disaster of some kind. Now, that reminded me of the Mothman, if you know that legend. I forget the state that was in. Was it West Virginia? Yeah. And they said, well, whenever the Mothman is seen, there's some big disaster. Well, sure enough, the last time it was seen, they had a big bridge in their city collapse, and a lot of people were killed. So that just further fueled that legend. But maybe we'll discuss the Mothman some other night. But in a way, it's kind of similar to this because, you know, they feel like if they see this dog, then something bad's going to happen. Well, anyway, let's cut away now to the late 19th and early, well, actually the entire 20th century. The encounters with this beast start to take on a more gentler tone, which is interesting. Some stories reported that the beasts were seen accompanying women home as if they were protecting them, and also others were reported to have helped lost travelers, which is interesting and unexpected. Some people said that what the people of Bungay experienced in August of 1577 was actually a severe thunderstorm that struck the church. And they explained that in that era, people were very superstitious and they attributed all sorts of things to the devil, in this case, of course, under the guise of this beastly dog. So I guess what they're saying is, well, maybe what the people have saw in the 1500s isn't the same thing that people in the 19th and 20th centuries have seen. That may be true, but apart from all of this, people still were seeing these animals in the countryside, and, you know, maybe they made a big deal about it, maybe they didn't, but the fact is something seems to be, because so many people have seen sightings of this over the centuries, so it seems like something is going on. People describe these dogs very often as being large for a dog, the size of a calf, perhaps, and sometimes they liken it to the size of a pony. Now, I should mention that it's not like an American pony where they grow into big horses. They have a breed of miniature ponies that roam the moors. So I'm not entirely sure how big that is, but this dog is likened to being about that size. And then further, locals describe their eyes as malevolent, flaming eyes, and they're either red or green and saucer-sized. Well, I imagine if you come upon one and you're startled, you know, you're frightened and all your own fright reflexes go into motion, and, you know, maybe their eyes do look saucer-sized. But I was thinking, too, you know, I lived in the country, and you know, I know at night some animals' eyes reflect very strangely, and they're only like, you know, possums or raccoons or something. So I don't know. I mean, it's so hard because there aren't any real hard facts to, you know, measure it against and you know, to evaluate the witnesses and what they experience. So I don't know about the dogs. Let's leave them for now. That's just what the legend has said and people have experienced over the centuries. And now we're going to switch to cats. And the reason is, nowadays, the sightings seem to have changed over to people seeing these large cat-like creatures. And they liken it most often to lions and pumas. And I have to wonder, well, what happened to the dogs? I don't know. Let's go back in history a minute and figure out, where is there a possible link to where these lions and pumas and God knows what else came from? Well, it turns out in the 1600s, wealthy landowners commissioned menageries. Now, a menagerie is like a private collection, like a little zoo. So they commissioned them on their own property, and they'd house these exotic animals from other lands there. Many researchers that I read suspect that these animals got away and started living and reproducing out on the moors. Adding to that, in 1976, Britain passed a Dangerous Animals Act, and that was created to make it hard for anyone to own a big cat or other, you know, unusual beast. They levied a tax on these owners and required them to have special licenses. Well, the cost was so prohibitive, many people just got rid of their animals. And you can probably guess how they did it. People think that they just let them go into the wild on the moors. So that begs the question, well, could these big animals survive out there? Well, it turns out lots of prey actually walk the moors of Britain. And it's mostly sheep. Well, you think of it, they're grassland. A good part of it is grassland, so I guess that makes sense. So it's mostly sheep. There's also the wild ponies. I recently learned that cattle also are grazed out there. Many carcasses have been found around the areas with their, sorry to say if you're squeamish, but with their necks ripped open and most of the carcass eaten. And according to what I read, these experts say that that's, you know, a pretty typical predation, I guess you'd say, from big cats. So it seems that there's enough food out there for them, depending on their own population. So, you know, it's hard to say what's roaming the moors of Britain. It's not easy to say, but I'm thinking there are probably multiple beasts. Now, let me see here. Oh, this is a great story. I was reading a skeptic website and what they had to say about these beasts. And they point to a story with pictures, by the way. So, I mean, I believe it was legit and not made up. There was a hiker out on the moor one day, and he saw a large, hairy, black animal from a distance. Now, it wasn't that far of a distance. You know, I mean, he was clearly visible. But not so close that you could say, oh, let's say, well, let me get on with the story because I don't want to ruin it for you. Okay, so the guy takes several good photos of this creature. He shared them with their local media, the newspapers and whatnot. A few days later, he gets a phone call from a woman who said that beast was her large Newfoundland dog and that he regularly visits that area on his daily romp. So I said to myself, well, let me look at what a Newfoundland dog looks like, and I'll tell you what, Google it, images, they're huge. These things are huge. So I had to look up the history of the breed, and I found some very compelling clues. And I'm going to quote to you now from Canada's Guide to Dogs, their website. Okay, quote, "The Canadian Kennel Club breed standard for Newfoundland dogs states that the breed originated in Newfoundland from dogs indigenous to the island and the big black bear dogs introduced by the Vikings in 1000 AD. While the exact origin of the Newfoundland dog is debated, the three most common theories are that the breed, A, evolved from the now extinct black wolf, which was crossed with the Asiatic Mastiff, B, developed by crossing native dogs and wolves with the dogs the Vikings brought to Newfoundland around 1000 AD. Today, the Newfoundland dog is seen all over the world, and most purebred Newfoundlands, even in Newfoundland, are descended from those born in England. So I thought that was very interesting. And here's how they described the animal's appearance. The Newfoundland is massive, well-muscled and coordinated, carrying himself with dignity. His coat is flat, dense, and water-resistant. The outer coat is moderately long and straight but can have a slight wave. The hair on the head, muzzle, and ears is short and fine, and he has a soft, dense undercoat. The traditional Newfoundland color is black. He may also have white markings on the chest, toes, and tip of the tail, unquote. So I had to find out if any of these Viking dogs still existed, and I found this fascinating site. If you're interested in Vikings and what their lives were like, check out VikingAnswerWoman.com. Fascinating site. I mean, she goes into what they ate, the kind of clothes they wore, what their society was like, and even their pets. So this is what I found out about those Viking dogs. They were called then the Karelian bear dog, and it existed in Northeast Europe and Scandinavia since Neolithic times. Modern descendants are called the Karelian bear dogs, and they're still quite popular in Finland, apparently. And the Vikings interbred the native Arctic wolf with southern dogs, in other words, that were coming up, say, through Europe and Russia. So, to me, that's a really good clue as to what, at least in terms of the dogs, what people might be seeing. Okay. Now, the other part of this discussion, we have to look at the Newfoundland dogs themselves. You know, they're described as being very gentle and protective, and it's interesting because this would account for the tales of the beast escorting women home and helping travelers from the 19th and 20th centuries. So the people may very well be seeing Newfoundland dogs, or I'm wondering if it isn't some kind of one of these Karelian bear dogs that took off and evolved over time on its own on the moor. I don't know, but we'll get to that when we talk to the professor. But other sightings clearly describe a feline beast with either a heavy mane or a very long, thin tail. And that sounds like a lion or puma. Now, I don't know if you caught the show where Fact or Fake went over to Britain and investigated the beasts of Dartmoor. It was another excellent show. And if you'd like to see what this video looked like, go to cryptoville.wordpress.com. That'll land you on the home page. Look to the right, and there's a series of like directories. Go down a bit, and you'll find most popular. Go in there, and it'll be the second article. And then when you get in the article, it's towards the end, the video link. And it's really, you know, considering what we usually see with cryptids, this is actually a good video. I thought, yeah, it does look like a lion, but it was, when it ran, it was awfully low to the ground. Well, what they did on Fact or Fake, they compared the size, the appearance, and the gait of the animal in the video to a real lion, a native pony, and a wild boar. Some people are actually saying that these things could be a wild boar or some kind of hybrid of wild boar. Honestly, I thought the lion would be the winner because of the lion's mane, and the beast's mane were very much alike. But the beast's gait was markedly different from the lion's. So their conclusion was like, well, we don't know. As far as we're concerned, the case is still open. So I guess it's still open, too, in my mind as well. Let's get with the professor and see what he has to say. Hold on a second here. Are you there, Charles?
I'm here.
Okay. So since we're talking about the cats, let's start there.
Okay.
What do you make of this theory that the cats were released into the moors and survived and reproduced through today?
So I guess I would say we have a cat or cats that have escaped in the wilds of Dartmoor in 1700, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a population of them that has existed to the present day, so for 300 years and change. And for a population of large predaceous mammals to exist for 300 years, there would have to be at least a handful of them existing at any one time in order to have a reproducing population, you'd figure.
Mm-hmm.
So, an example that immediately comes to mind is Florida panthers.
Mm-hmm.
Where you live in Florida, you're familiar with, no doubt. There's
beautiful creatures, yeah.
Something on the order of 100 of them, I think, living in South Florida in the Everglades, which is a large, wild area that I'm sure the Everglades are more impassable or less passable than the moors of Dartmoor, I would guess.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they find them dead on the highway all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So my question then is, if there's this population of large predaceous animals living in the wilds of England, how come no one has ever turned one up on the highway in the last 300 years or so? Which is to say, what's the legal term, corpus delicti, right? Show me the body.
You know, that's an excellent point, and that's a problem every cryptid has that we talk about. I mean, not the least of which is Bigfoot.
Yep.
You know, where are the bodies? I don't know. You know, my only thought is, you know how when a house cat, this is what people tell me. I've not actually had one, but they say when they believe they're going to die or whatever, they go off and they hide somewhere, and most families never see them again. Is it possible that lions would do something like that?
Oh, I would certainly think it's possible that lions would do that, and yet the streets are full of dead house cats. So I'm not talking about panthers, Florida panthers, that have died of old age or natural causes. I'm talking about them getting run over by beer trucks.
Yeah.
Stuff. So now I don't know what obviously there are, it's a passable enough area for people to see them all the time. So I would, I'm extremely skeptical because, for no other reason than if there were this, even a smallish population of, a dozen or two at any one time, you figure how come nobody's ever
run
over one driving home from the bar?
Yeah.
Which is,
I'd have to imagine if they did find a carcass or something, it would send up a real hue and cry in the, the media.
I would expect so. It's just like if a dead Loch Ness monster washed up on the beach,
mm-hmm.
It would make the papers.
Right, right. You know, it's funny you should say that. On the blog, I have this, some years ago, these Japanese fishermen hauled in this carcass. It was very badly decayed, but honest to God, it looked just like a plesiosaur, the way the thing
mm-hmm.
hung there, and people were all agog. Oh, this is proof. Well, it turns out that it was a basking shark, the one with the big gills on the
mm-hmm.
side. And I read that they were the first ones. They're the first things to rot, so that leaves this pointy thing, which is its nose. But when it hangs there, it looks like the head of a plesiosaur. I mean, so stuff like that, can be misidentified and
sure.
It's really tough. That's a tough call. Well, then, what do you think about say the lions are there, let's just say for all intents and purposes, could they have mutated differently than what happened to their African relatives? Because I'm just thinking of the gait. you know, the way this thing ran, it just didn't look quite right in the rear quarters.
So there I will support you, or I will support the fans of the beast. And I, in my mind, the answer is yes, absolutely. Because
okay.
let's think about dogs in Germany and Switzerland, which are the home of the Saint Bernard and the miniature Dachshund. And think about the different sort of just the morphological differences, the differences in size and shape and gait and all sorts of things in between Saint Bernards and Dachshunds. And I don't know how many generations have passed since their common ancestor, but probably not that many. And obviously this is a product of very strong artificial selection, because people have bred these dogs. But in a small population with mutation and genetic variation, you can get an awful lot of phenotypic change very quickly in terms of numbers of generations. The evolutionary argument is totally plausible. The ecological argument, which is to say, how come nobody's ever turned up a dead one, that's what makes me think it's balderdash.
Okay. Now, when you say phenotypic changes, could you just explain to us what that is?
Sure. The phenotype, that's just a fancy word for any material property of an organism, something like its height or its weight or its shape or its color or its personality or whatever.
Okay. So that's very interesting. Now, so if these things were let loose, let's say, in the 1600s, it seems possible that they might have mutated somehow on their own. And you know what else, too? A lot of these lions, and I've seen this in the news lately, it seems like everywhere all of a sudden we're seeing black lions and white lions. But their coloration, that's a different, isn't that a different type of genetic process than, say, changing their whole body and the way they run?
Yeah, well, the melanin pathway, which by which you get a black animal, is really well known. And you get melanic phenotypes of pretty much any animal you can think of. Occasionally a jet black one shows up, and this would be in the coat. And in fact, you see it in fish, and you see it in herps, reptiles.
Mm-hmm.
So to get a black, an all-black animal occasionally crop up is extremely common.
And that's not something they particularly pass on to their offspring. Is that correct? Because it's more like a fluke?
I guess I would say the answer there is maybe yes and maybe no. It would depend on whether the mutation occurred in the germline, which is to say the sperm or the egg, right? Or
mm-hmm.
if it was a somatic mutation, which is just sort of a mutation early in the development of the organism where now most of its coat is black. But it's certainly possible to have a mutation that could be passed on to the offspring.
Mm, that's interesting. Because the one that I'm referring to from the Fact or Fake show does seem to be black. Recently I've seen in news stories, they weren't even approaching it like a crypto story. All of a sudden there's these black and white ones all over. In fact, there's even a pink dolphin, if anyone's interested. I know I saw like a commercial tonight, but there's actually a pink dolphin in a lake. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's like Calcasieu in Louisiana. And, the biologists down there have seen it and confirmed that it's actually a little albino. And apparently when they go albino, they turn like bright pink. It's just the cutest thing.
That is a different mutation in the melanin pathway, and albinos are, you can sort of think of it as the flip side of totally melanic, of all black. And albino animals, from mammals to reptiles to fish are extremely common.
Really? Common? That's interesting.
Well, I mean, I say common. They crop up constantly.
Okay. But it's not like an everyday occurrence, but it's not uncommon to see them, is what you're saying.
No, yeah, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I would not be surprised to see an albino anything.
Okay.
Or a melanic anything.
Okay.
Animal, vertebrate.
Okay, well, let's get back to the dogs then.
Okay.
You know, you heard what I was saying about the Newfoundland dogs and their history, and now these, what the heck was the name of that, Kerpelian or something, Karelian bear dog. I don't know, to me that's sounding more like the dogs that people were seeing were some kind of ancestors from that. What do you think?
I suppose that's possible. There, you know, I mean, you ask, if you let dogs go out in the wild for a few generations, you get all, actually they typically revert to something that looks pretty much like a coyote.
Really?
But there, you know, certainly you get all different colors, and I could imagine that there would be some pretty big ones. And I could, and the point you were making earlier about if you're walking home late at night and a dog barks at you, you might tend to think it's bigger than it really is.
Yeah, because again, you lose that sense of what is the expression? That sense of proportion or perspective.
Sure. And this is,
you know, I mean,
you know,
like when we talk about
thing.
UFOs and everything, and they're being seen up in the sky, I mean, how do you begin to measure something like that? You know, you can't, because that's, you're essentially looking into infinity, right? So,
with the giant dogs, suppose there was a breed of giant dogs roaming about the moors. It's, you know, same thing. First of all, you know, and actually this holds true for the lions as well. Not even where's the corpse, but you would expect to see footprints of them.
Mm-hmm.
And not that footprints can't be easily faked, because they can.
As we know with Bigfoot.
Easier than faking a dead lion.
Yeah.
But you would expect to see atypically large dog footprints from time to time. Maybe people find them, but
yeah, maybe that's the thing. Maybe they do find them, but we don't hear about it because they don't put it on the internet, or
atypically large piles of dog poop in somebody's yard.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
You know,
sure.
Dogs leave evidence behind that you would expect it would scale with the size.
Well, now tell me something. Let's just say some Newfoundland dogs or these the Viking dogs. Let's say they got away and went wild hundreds of years ago on the moors and whatever. And so there's a chance then that they could have evolved a little differently just because, you know, man's not interfering?
Absolutely. And dogs are the perfect example of it, because think of how much variation there is just, you know, in the domestic dogs we're all familiar with. And, you know, how much bigger is a Newfoundland than a Chihuahua? It's order, you know, sort of 5 pounds versus 150 pounds. That's 30 times bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So it is certainly possible. It is not beyond the realm of imagination that you could have something evolve that much bigger than a Newfie. So if you had a dog, now there's reasons you wouldn't want to breed a dog that was big enough to eat you.
Yes.
By itself, you know, if my house cat sitting here kind of gnawing on my paw, gnawing on my hand here, and you know that if your house cat was as big as a Newfie, it would eat you.
Yeah.
So I think that's why we haven't bred house cats that big, but it's certainly at least completely plausible that, you know, a dog could evolve to be that big.
Interesting, very interesting. And
I'm not saying it's likely, but it's plausible.
It's possible. Right. It's possible. Yeah. And of course, if they got, involved with wolves, but wolves are smaller to me, it seems like, than these newfies even. I don't really know. That might make them smaller.
Yeah, a big timber wolf is 150 pounds or so, I think. So that's a big animal, but it's not 500 pounds.
That's about as big as those newfies get from somewhere wherever I read, yeah. Well, that's interesting. You know, too, I was looking into the habitats on this moor, and at first I thought a moor was just grassland,
mm-hmm.
but apparently there's quite a lot of variation in there. In fact, they've got what they call broadleaf valley woodlands, bracken, heaths, and then these big, tall stone features left over from the ice ages or whatever. They call them tors. Then there's areas of bog.
I tend to think of bogs and marshes when I think of moors.
Okay, interesting. But they do, from what I researched, there does seem to be quite a bit of grassland, too, which is why I guess they put the cattle and the the sheep out there. Oh, by the way, would let's just say a feral dog was living out there. Would they eat the sheep and the ponies?
Oh, absolutely. A pack of dogs will decimate sheep, cattle, ponies, deer.
Okay. Well, this thing I was reading has a list of the major habitats in Dartmoor and the different animals that live in each habitat. And basically, okay, so apart from the cattle, sheep, the ponies, there are things like voles and other things I don't recognize, but I think they're small mammals. It's within the range of predators such as foxes and buzzards. Lots of birds, lots of lizardy type things. So I'm thinking, well, okay, we're not finding bodies, and both these things would probably hunt at night. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so then maybe they could go around to these different areas.
Yeah.
Certainly in the woodlands they could hide, and maybe up in some caves around the tor. Because, in fact, that picture of that Newfoundland dog that the man took and then the lady called and said that was her pet, he was around those tors. You could see them in the background.
Mm.
So if anything's there, I'd have to think there's good enough places to hide and stuff to eat. But then, as you say, where are the footprints and where are the bodies? You know, and there's a lot of like you say, roads and towns around there too. So I have to think that's an interesting point. Well, I don't know. I really don't know what.
Well, how come they're seen so rarely? I mean, mountain lions, for example, are very common in much of North America. And I know people who live in, spent their whole lives in areas that are frequented by mountain lions, and they've never seen one. So, wild animals try not to be seen, especially wild predators.
You know, that is such an excellent point, Charles. And not only that, but I'm extrapolating that out to Bigfoot. Because I have to be honest with you, of all the stuff that I talk about, the one thing I feel sure it's only a matter of time before somebody bags a body is Bigfoot. But maybe I'll bring you back for that discussion sometime.
Sure, please do. Please do.
We haven't discussed that yet, but there's so much different evidence and stuff going on. And by the way, my money is still on the Texans for bagging the body because of their websites and everything. They do seem to be able to shoot anything. So, but in terms of the Bigfoot and keeping out of the way, to me, those creatures are the masters of it. And as many people have said, who can blame them? Because all they got to do is watch us for a while and see, how we can mess stuff up. So I don't know. I don't know if any of that's true. But what you said about the oh, my gosh, I just forgot it. What were you just talking about, that animal?
Oh,
in the woods. Was it the bobcat?
Oh, well, I was talking about mountain lions. But bobcats are a good example. I've lived in bobcat country my whole life. The only time I ever see them is, you know, driving down country roads at night. And you'll see them in the headlights.
Really? By the way, is that around Florida?
Oh, yeah.
They're here in Florida?
Yeah.
I'm fascinated to know that. Interesting. So, but like the other one that you mentioned, that the mountain lion, okay, so people know they're in the area, and yet they never see them. Well, and then here we have
the tracks, and you see them dead on the road.
That too.
When I say never seen one, I mean never seen a live one.
Okay. Okay. And now, you know, in terms of, I was wondering, how big are these moors? Dartmoor was the only one I could come up with an actual number, and that has been measured at 368 square miles. Parts of it rise up to 2,037 feet above sea level, which surprised me too. But I said, well, I don't really have a good idea what 368 square miles is, so I did some more research, and I found out Mount Rainier State Park is also exactly 368 square miles.
So it's, I mean, 20 by 20 miles is 400 square miles. So
okay.
20 mile square, which is not that big.
Now that you put it that way, it certainly doesn't seem so. Well,
you wouldn't figure that would support very many lions.
I'm thinking, yeah. And even for that matter, big dogs, because let's face it, they're, you know.
Dogs get found 20 miles from home all the time.
True. By the way, my listeners, that Mount Rainier State Park, it's also in Washington State, if you hadn't heard of it, near Mount St. Helens and Yakima, which we were talking about the other week with that Mount Washington and the UFOs and everything. So anyway. Well, that's interesting. I wish I could get on the chat room and see if anyone else had any more questions. Let me just see if I can pull that up.
Okay.
Were you able to pull it up at all, Charles?
You know, I have what I've got here on my computer as I look up the chupacabra, which is I grew up in Texas, and the chupacabra is our sort of local legendary beast.
I didn't mean to insult you about them shooting the Bigfoot.
that could be another show, but no, I haven't looked up the chat room on your show.
Okay, let me see. I just popped into it, and I don't see anything. I don't see anybody. Well, if you have any questions, folks, pop them up in the chat room, and we'll get to them. Well, you know, the only reason why I said that, Charles, was because there's this website, and I can't remember the exact name of it. But I will mention it when I do the talk about Bigfoot, because I'm getting distracted now by the chat room. Hi, Carla. and Subu. Okay, this is my first time pulling out the chat room, and I know I'm like a cat. If you flash something in front of me, I've got to look at it. That's how it is with the chat room. But anyway, I'll look away for a minute. But back to this Texan Bigfoot hunting group. One thing I never realized was the east part of Texas is forested, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And these
now,
guys
I haven't heard rumors of Bigfoot sightings there, but I haven't lived there for a while either.
Yeah, well, then I'm definitely going to have you back for the Bigfoot show. In fact, that's going to be a good one. Not that this isn't, but I just mean he's my favorite, and there's lots going on with
Bigfoot for sure.
Yeah, but anyway, but that's what caused me to say that, you know, I'm anticipating that the Texans are going to be the ones to shoot it because they're so enthusiastic,
you know,
and they're out there with the guns and all that.
Don't bet against the drunken Alaskan.
There you go, that too.
Of course, there's plenty.
Somebody said here a small population can get lost in 400 miles. Well, or 368, I suppose. But then again, we get back to, would they still be able to breed and continue the line if it was too small a population? Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you would have to have a... you'd think at least a dozen of them or so, or 10 at any one time. I'm pretty much making that number up, but it's just it's okay. We're talking 300 years or something, and if they were there, you'd figure one would turn up dead once.
Yeah.
That's what I think. Or that, you would see, footprints would turn up on a muddy road. And like I said, footprints are easy to fake, but...
I don't really see people faking...
Another thing is, animals are typically creatures of habit, right? And they have their trails, and often those trails cross humans' trails or humans' roads. And somebody would, have a trail of them through their back pasture or something.
Yeah. We talk about this often enough on this show. Trying to get reliable witnesses and data and photos and videos of these things, especially like with the UFOs, it's almost enough to make me weep because everything is out of focus. Everything is 42,000 miles away from, you almost can't see it in the video. The Bigfoot things, same thing. The cameras are shaking. They're out of focus. I mean, I guess I'd be scared too, but, oh, Lord, if someone could just get a decent photo, And it's like this with the beasts on the moors. I mean, if you see some big creature you don't immediately recognize, you're going to be startled, and then your fight or flight thing and the adrenaline starts kicking in, and... you're not getting the most, let's say, scientific and reasonable impression,
Mm-hmm.
But then again, there are some sightings of things that I give more credence to, and that's basically if people like in the military are seeing this stuff or in law enforcement, because, they're supposed to be trained observers,
mm-hmm.
But none of them have reported any signs of, Bigfoot they have. But not certainly not the Beast of Dartmoor, not that we know. So I don't know. It's that I have
when some country sheriff comes in and reports one, then we'll.
Well, who else is a good observer? Are these people who have been hunting for 30 years or something?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's what I was thinking, right? So
yeah.
The guy sitting up in his deer stand. With, of course, oftentimes one might have a flask of whiskey in his pocket to keep him warm.
Yeah.
Or so I hear.
You wouldn't know. Well, that's just a frustration we have in the cryptozoological world, is how do you nail this stuff down? And I think the best thing, we try to do is just approach it as scientifically as we can, rule out what we can, and then...
Rule out the obvious.
Yeah, and then maybe what we're left with is evidence and maybe not, Oh, someone had a good point here, Carla. It may be possible that the Bigfoot creatures are repelled by the smell of humans. Well, we don't know yet, but quite possibly...
pretty much any other wildlife that has managed to not have us drive them extinct sure gets up and run when they get a nose full of humans.
Yeah, I bet.
So I would expect that.
Yeah, you would, wouldn't you? I'm going to save the Bigfoot stuff for the show. For the other show. All right, let's just see. Has anyone else got any more questions? No, not really. Not really. Well, I think at the end of the day, I don't doubt that people are seeing something. It's just we don't know what they're seeing. And the dogs, I'm leaning more towards it's either the Newfies or some wild, whatever that other one was, I don't know where I put it, but the Viking dog.
The Carillion bear dog.
That one, Carillion, yeah. That's probably what they're seeing, and they don't recognize it. And then as far as the cats, I don't know.
I'll give you an example. So twice in my life, And once recently, I have been driving in a car with somebody in Bear Country. Well, actually, mm-hmm. once in Bear Country and once from College Station, Texas to Houston, which mm-hmm. is not Bear Country. Mm-hmm. And the person in the car with me shouts, "A bear! I saw a bear!" So I hit the brakes and look over, and there is a black cow peacefully chewing its cud in the field.
Oh. So
if you're expecting to see a bear and you see like a big black thing, boy, it looks like a bear, and then you sort of look more carefully.
Yeah.
And if it's the middle of the day, in the middle of a pasture, you're like, oh yeah, that's a cow. And if it's the middle of the moors at 10 o'clock at night and you're swerving home from the pub,
right,
you get
right.
one look and like, oh man, I saw the Beast of Dartmoor. It was.
You know something else, Charles? They have a lot of foggy, crazy weather over there. So even if it was a daylight sighting, you know, it's
sure.
so misty and at times spooky looking over there, you know, with the fog and the mist and the rain and everything, and that might play into it too. Now, I see we are out of time. Boy, that wound up going a lot more quickly than I anticipated.
That went fast.
Yes, it did. Charles, thank you so much for joining us here today, and
okay,
it's been a
real pleasure,
and I hope we can have you back and talk about some other things, for instance, like the Bigfoot, and try and see what science has to say about that.
Okay.
All righty. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say good night. Thank you.
Oh, good night to you, too.
This was fun. Bye.
It was. Good night. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us this evening. I got to hurry off here. I'll be back in 2 weeks. That's September 7th already. Can you believe it? And the topic for the next show is going to be Vietnam's Bigfoot. Now, this is just a subsection to the whole Bigfoot world, but we're going to just cover that one. As always, you can reach me on cryptoville.wordpress.com or on the Facebook page Cryptoville. Well, thanks again for joining us. I'm wishing you all a good night, sweet dreams, and God bless. Bye.